This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, it's 7:05 in the morning. And of course, you're Thursday, the 22nd of April. And of course, you're listening to Philip C. And I'm Wong Xiaoning. Now, in about 15 minutes, we'll be speaking to Alizan Mahadi, who's the Director of Technology, Innovation, Environment and Sustainability Division at ICIS Malaysia on climate change issues in the country. But before that, let's take a quick look at markets.
Yeah, so in the US, I think they snapped that two-day decline with a very strong performance. Dow and S&P both up 0.9%. The Nasdaq was up 1.2%. However, Asia, I think, is following suit from the previous day of underperformance in the US. Shanghai was flat. Nikkei was down 2% again. Hang Seng was down 1.8%. Singapore down 1.2%. KLCI slightly down 0.7%.
Yeah, so for more on where global markets are heading, we speak to Vishnu Varathan, who is the head of economics and strategy at Mizuho Bank. Good morning, Vishnu. Now, first off, according to JP Morgan, the Chinese yuan is the most overvalued currency and might stoke global inflation. So, do you agree with JP Morgan? Is the Chinese currency the most overvalued?
Well, I think, you know, to start off, we need to say two things about this. First, we need to unpack the valuation of the Chinese currency and global inflation. So let's start with the Chinese currency. It is a very difficult thing to do, and there are many ways to skin the cat when you wanted to talk about an overvalued or undervalued currency. But one of the indicators that it may not actually be very overvalued or undervalued is the fact that Chinese trade, merchandise trade, has not been impacted by the valuation of the currency. In fact, it has continued to fairly thrive. And another way to look at it is, even if it's slightly more overvalued, this is probably a rebalancing of its huge current account surplus, particularly as Chinese tourists go out and spend a higher value renminbi, and it helps with global rebalancing. But the biggest risk of all is that the US Treasury will not agree that the Chinese currency is overvalued, and any attempt to correct that could in fact spark a currency war with far greater and dire consequences. So for those reasons, the overvaluation of the Chinese currency, I think, is beside the point. Global inflation, whereas global inflation is going to be stoked by huge reflationary policies that's pushing up commodity prices, and in so far that, you know, the Chinese currency and Chinese trade helped with the great disinflation of the 90s, I don't see it single-handedly contributing to global inflation, so it would be misplacing blame as well.
But with a stronger yuan, does this affect the competitiveness of China exports and give leverage and opportunity to other manufacturing economies around Asia?
And that's a great question, and you hit the nail on the head. So, which is why, again, the argument doesn't make sense, because if indeed the Chinese currency is overvalued, then we should naturally see competitors gaining an upper hand. And so global inflation should be kept in check by the alternatives and cheaper currencies, whereas on both fronts, it doesn't seem to be there, because first, China is entering into higher value-added products where currency competitiveness is not the core issue. And also, the trade tensions means that there are other aspects, of course, not the currencies. So the fact that Chinese goods remain a bugbear of undercutting locals means that an overvalued currency is not an argument that's going to stick, not in this climate anyway.
And if we look at the US, Fed Chair Powell admits to the prospect of a little higher inflation, but at the same time doesn't see it exceeding 2% by much. Do you share the same benign view of inflationary pressures as he does?
Xiaoning, I'm so sorry to bring up the cat again when I told you there are many ways to skin the cat.
This
again.
Poor cat is dead.
Yeah, it's been skinned more than once. And that's the trouble with inflation as well, because how we want to measure inflation, it's not hard and fast. So I generally share Fed Powell's view on two grounds. One is, whatever inflation that overshoots significantly that we expect to come through will probably be transitory, at least in the initial phases. And that's exactly what the Fed wants. They just want this initial phase for us to look through it so they can continue with the policy. Also, the underlying inflation which depends on which axis you resort to, should not also exceed 2% by very much. And the fundamental reason for that is, even though the recovery is at a pretty good pace, or at least expected to be in the US, there's still a lot of global spare capacity that should absorb once we look past transitory cost push. And whatever demand pull that comes through later will need to be dealt with probably in late 2022 in 2023.
So dealing with this demand, this was the letter that he wrote to the Republicans, right, where he said that the Fed is committed to limit any overshoot. What are the instruments and tools that the Fed can apply to ensure that doesn't happen in the future then?
I think, there are a few things we can say about this. When you say limit overshoot, he's also not being very clear, because I think the Fed previously also committed to the fact that they will allow the overshoot for a while to make up for, you know, a prolonged undershoot. So that's the first thing to take note. And when it comes to tools, our starting point is, you know, monetary policy often is asymmetric. It's a lot more effective in bringing down inflation than bringing up growth and inflation again. So I think he's not so concerned. And he's already given us a hint by saying that the tapering or the reduction of bond purchases will be well ahead of interest rate hikes. So I think he's going to resort to the balance sheet measures first, reining them in, then interest rates come.
But Vishnu, if we look a little bit beyond the US and we start looking at some of the emerging economies, what we do see coming out of there is data that suggests, a CPI data that suggests that inflation is starting to creep up, especially in the in terms of cost of food and also in terms of oil. So what kind of pressure will emerging markets face in terms of their interest rate direction then?
I think that is the dilemma for, you know, EM central bankers. They're caught between a rock and a hard place. So they're stuck with this cost push inflation, which is eventually deflationary, if you think about it, because it's eroding margins, it's eroding discretionary income. So it's not giving rise to a quick pickup in demand. Whereas they need to deal with this because it has got an impact on confidence and capital flows that could further destabilize currency and accentuate and exaggerate the problem. So this exacerbated inflationary pressures probably has EM central bankers at the edge of their seats, thinking how long they can hold on to policy accommodation, because the economy does need the accommodation, but then at which point they need to prioritize price stability over continued as emphatic growth boost. So it is a policy dilemma, and there's no other way to put it. We don't want to play this down either.
Let's talk about emerging markets deeper into a really big dilemma, which is in India. There's a second wave of virus cases that are threatening recovery prospects. What measures can the RBI take to mitigate adverse effects on India's sovereign credit rating, as well as restore investor confidence in markets?
I mean, that's really the RBI's big conundrum now, because one of the key things is that their lack of options and inaction may be the bigger thing, because they need to hold on to rupee stability and also, shore up confidence that they're not going to do debt monetization, things that could, accentuate and exacerbate their credit risks. So they have to deal with making sure that they don't get a credit ratings risk rising. So they need to also make sure that growth is fairly supported so that they can grow out of their current fiscal problems, so on and so forth. But in the very near term, This is a ball that is in the court of the healthcare authorities, not the RBI. So RBI is not front and center of this.
And Vishnu, since we are going around the world, we have to end with Europe because we've been everywhere. So what do you foresee at tonight's ECB meeting? I mean, will they stand pat on interest rates and bond purchases, or actually tweak them?
The backdrop against of this is that Bank of Canada started tapering their bond purchases. What we can say is that the ECB is nowhere near that, but they are more inclined to stand pat because, even at the last meeting, they already alluded to the fact that they see balanced risks. So they're not too worried about downside. What they were worried about was a very, very rapid and unrestrained rise in long-term interest rates, long yields. That has abated somewhat. So I think this is the meeting where they stand pat. And because they're not doing economic revisions, so on and so forth, it also means that markets would not be, trying to tear apart what they are saying either. So this is a really wait and watch meeting.
All right. Thank you for your time. That was Vishnu Varathan, Head of Economics and Strategy at Mizuho Bank. pretty much summing up that inflation is the one thing to watch very, very closely. I mean, different countries have different pressures, so less so in the US, more so in emerging markets. East in Europe, not really so much at the moment, but I think we definitely have to be watching this very closely because inflation will be the determinant of interest rate hikes.
I think two things struck is, I think in Europe, they're going to best stay firm, although they're watching very closely what's happening in Italy, because I think Mario Draghi is going to launch a pretty large stimulus plan there. I was struck with India, where he really said the RBI really has not many tools or many options to do, and it's really at the hands of the health ministry officials. That truly struck me, Sheldon.
And unfortunately, India is really having a very tough time flattening the pandemic curve. A lot of pressure on the healthcare system. But very quickly, Verizon Communications tops earnings and revenues expectations. The company reported first quarter net income of $5.4 billion. It's actually up 26% on year. Earnings per share was $1.27. But Verizon lost regular wireless subscribers for the first time in a year. A troubling sign as the company tries to catch up with rivals AT&T and T-Mobile US in a race for 5G consumers. So this is the largest US wireless carrier, posted a loss of 170,000 monthly wire subscribers in the first quarter.
I mean, Bloomberg had predicted 82,000 new customers. So this is really a big under expectation result. I mean, they had declined their commitments for wireless spectrum that will impact its financials. They paid about $45 billion to the FCC, but really it doesn't look good news for
them. Not such good news. But up next, we'll be speaking to Alizan Mahadi, Director of Technology, Innovation, Environment and Sustainability Division at ICIS Malaysia, on the outcomes from the Malaysian Climate Change Action Council. Stay tuned for that, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.